You know, ever since man has started gazing into the heavens, he's always wondered, is there intelligent life out there? Are we alone in the universe? Perplexing thoughts and questions. In a moment, a debate between Seth Shostak from the SETI Institute and Stanton Friedman, father of modern-day ufology. We're going to talk about the possibility of life out there in the universe and whether that life has indeed come here to planet Earth. I shall present to you our guests in alphabetical order. Stanton Friedman received his Bachelor of Science and his Master's of Science degrees in physics from the University of Chicago. He worked for 14 years as a nuclear physicist on advanced, highly classified, eventually canceled projects such as nuclear aircraft, fission and fusion rockets, and nuclear power plants for space. Stan is the original civilian investigator of the Roswell incident, who co-authored Crash at Corona and instigated the Unsolved Mysteries Roswell Project. He was heavily involved in both the 1979 documentary UFOs Are Real and the 1993 and 1996 videos Flying Saucers Are Real. Stan has provided testimony to congressional hearings, appeared twice at the United Nations, and pioneered many aspects of ufology, including the Betty Hill Star Map work, Crashed Saucers, an analysis of the Delphos physical trace case. And when I was a young puppy at the age of 21, he was my very first radio interview. Stanton, welcome to Coast tonight. How
glad
are you?
Glad to be on again, George. Makes me feel old, but what the heck?
Good to have you. And, of course, Seth Shostak is an astronomer involved with Project Phoenix. He's got a Bachelor of Arts degree in physics from Princeton and a Ph.D. in astronomy from Caltech. He is responsible for much of the outreach activities of the Institute. He edits the newsletter, gives talks, and writes magazine articles and books about SETI. In addition, he teaches a half a dozen informal education classes on astronomy and other topics in the Bay Area. Before coming to SETI, Seth did research work on galaxies using radio telescopes at observatories and universities in America and Europe. His avocations include photography, filmmaking, electronics. Seth has produced a series of lectures on tape and video on the subject of SETI and is a regular contributor as well to Coast AM. Seth, welcome back, and how are you feeling now? That was quite a bout you had a few weeks ago, wasn't it?
It was indeed, George, and I apologize that I wasn't able to do the show, but I'm, as you can hear, if not articulate, at least voluble.
You are back. I guess with both of you, we don't have ground rules because you're both gentlemen. You're both good at what you do. So what I'd like to do is just start by just getting a little statement from each of you about your own specific beliefs. Then we'll get into a Q&A, and then I'm going to kind of open it up a little bit more for you, Stanton and Seth, where you can do a little by-play back and forth along with the Q&A, okay?
Sure.
And the last hour, we'll just open it up to phone calls from coast-to-coast listeners, and they can address calls to either one of you. So you, Mr. Friedman, as we go in alphabetical order, give me a little statement on just your thoughts of tonight's topic at hand, and that is the belief of UFOs.
Well, I'm convinced after, since 46 years of study and investigation, that the evidence is overwhelming that planet Earth is being visited by intelligently controlled extraterrestrial spacecraft. In other words, some, underlined about 18 times, some UFOs are alien spacecraft. Two, we're dealing with a kind of cosmic Watergate, meaning some few people within major governments have known since July 1947, at least, that some UFOs are alien spacecraft because of the recovery of two crash flying saucers and alien bodies in New Mexico. Three, that none of the arguments made against the first two conclusions stand up under careful scrutiny. And finally, four, we're dealing with the biggest story of the millennium, that is, visits to planet Earth, successful cover-up of the best data, bodies, and wreckage for 57 years. Now, when it comes to ufology versus, I was going to say SETIology, but I don't think there is such a word. I think that a lot of good scientists with a strong interest in SETI. Unfortunately, I believe that the SETI program is based on a number of assumptions having no basis in fact. And assuming, for example, that there's nobody coming here, that radio is the ultimate means of communication, that if aliens were coming here, they would know about it, that there is no colonization, no migration, that we need to talk about great distances before there's anybody out there, and that we can't possibly be a threat to anybody out there. They also assume that there's no national security aspect to the notion of alien visitations, despite the fact that obviously every military group in the world would love to get their hands on something with the capabilities of flying saucers. So there's a clear and definite difference. They ignore the UFO data. We ufologists look at the SETI data and we say, hey, where's your evidence? They want us to provide a body. We want them to provide any kind of evidence that there's anybody out there sending signals. I'm not saying there isn't. I think there is loads of creatures, I'll say, beings out there. I don't think we're really worth talking to as equals, partly because people tend to neglect the time factor here. We have had civilization thousands of years, but the planet's been suitable for intelligent life, for a billion years. We don't know how many civilizations have come and gone, what the past history of our own planet is, and for all we know, some of the nearby stars. I'm only interested in the local neighborhood, small town guy, you know, within 54 light years, 1,000 stars, of which about 46 are similar to the sun. Within that small distance, there are stars that are a billion years older than the sun. The notion that they're stuck at either chemical rocket productions or radio for communication is, to me, silly.
Okay, Seth, let's get your take on the possibility of life in the universe and UFO visitation.
Well, let me just, I'll try and be succinct here, George. Let me just say that, to begin with, Stanton and I actually do agree on one premise here, which underlies the whole discussion, and that is the possibility that there may be other intelligent life in the galaxy. Obviously, Stanton believes that. In fact, he thinks they're buzzing the countryside. I agree that intelligent life is not such a rare phenomenon that we would never find evidence of it in our neighborhood. I think that it's a frequent enough phenomenon that we can and that we will. I think where we disagree is first on many of the things that Stan said about the SETI program. I hope that we'll get into this. I hope that it won't become a debate between me and Stanton about, for example, Roswell, because, as Stanton would be very quick to point out, I am not an investigator of UFOlogy, as you call it. That's not my bag. I'm an astronomer, and we're doing an experiment to try and prove that we have some cosmic company, if you will. I would say right off, we have not found that evidence, and I think that's an important difference between me and Stanton, because while he's claiming that he has found the evidence and they're here, which, as he has said, would be an incredibly important discovery, I don't find that evidence terribly compelling, and I'm eager to hear exactly how compelling it is. We don't make that claim, but if we do find something, I don't think that it's going to be like these claims of the ufologists that were being visited. I think it's going to be a claim that can be verified by many, many people in many different ways, and that there will be no doubt that we have found something interesting.
Well, what I find fascinating, though, about both of you is that you do agree on the fact that there could be, and there probably is, intelligent extraterrestrial life out there, because there are some who would not agree with either one of you that there's any life out there at all. Stanton?
Well, yeah, that's certainly true. And the question, of course, boils down, and Seth has talked about this, about are we unique or not? Is there anything so special about us that it couldn't have happened anyplace else, not only in the local neighborhood, but in the whole darn galaxy? And I don't worry about other galaxies. I'd like to use, I wish people would forget the word intergalactic. I'd much prefer intragalactic. So, yeah, there are people like that. And I find, in all my lecturing, I find that you've got your bell-shaped curve. You've got the extremists at both ends of the spectrum who say, I'm absolutely sure there is no life out there. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. There can't be any other life besides here. And there's certain religious groups that take that attitude. There's the other extremists who say, Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. They're here to save me. And I don't try to aim at either one of those groups, and I know that Seth doesn't. So it's the healthy agnostics in between. There will always be extremists on any subject you can name. And neither one of us, I think, is concerned with those people. There's not much you can do with them. If they say, don't bother me with the facts, my mind's made up, what follows has nothing to do with science.
When I first met you, Stanton, I was in Detroit as a reporter. You were going to universities talking about UFO visitations. It was 1971. You were at Oakland University, which was in Oakland County, just a little north of Detroit. Now, that was 1971. Roswell, of course, happened in 1947. Was it the Roswell case that got you interested in UFOs, or was there something else there in between?
Oh, not at all. I didn't start into Roswell until late in the 70s. I read a lot of one book in particular, The Air Force Report on Unidentified Flying Objects. That was back in 1958 when I was working on a very far-out program, nuclear aircraft. That led to me reading 15 other books, led to visits to Project Blue Book, to a discovery of Project Blue Book Special Report 14 with an enormous amount of data and clear proof that the Air Force was lying through its teeth about the data that they had obtained for Blue Book. So before I got into Roswell heavily, which was 1978, and it didn't figure at all in my early stuff, it's
right.
Mentioned once in Frank Edwards' book, half a page, Flying Saucers, Serious Business, but he got all the facts wrong anyway. So, no, Roswell was at the end of a long period of serious communication investigation. Wasn't the beginning at all. Unfortunately, I still seem to be stuck. I was there 10 days ago in Roswell. But no, it was not the beginning. In retrospect, it was an extraordinarily important event because it set the tone for 57 years of misrepresentation, cover-up, et cetera.
Make sure you remind me, Stanton, because someone told me that you were handed a piece of metal or something from while you were in Roswell, and I want to get into that with you later just to tell me if...
Okay, yes, I will talk about that.
Okay. Seth, how about you? I mean, here you are. You are an astronomer, your PhD from Caltech. At what point did you decide in your career, I'm going to join SETI, and I'm going to be part of this search for extraterrestrial intelligence?
Well, that's kind of a personal history. I'm not, it's a very diffuse one in a sense. But I, of course, even as a kid, I was interested in the idea of extraterrestrial life. I think most young people are today, perhaps more so than even then. And when I was interested, of course, that was before the Civil War, I think. But in any case, when I was a graduate student, actually, and using radio telescopes to study galaxies, a book had come out. It appeared. It was a book by Carl Sagan and a Russian physicist by the name of Joseph Schlossky called Intelligent Life in the Universe. And it discussed sort of a scientific approach to the possibility of the existence of extraterrestrial intelligence and how you might find it. Okay. And I was reading this very late one night at the radio observatory. It was 3 in the morning. I actually have a picture of this because at 3 in the morning there was nobody else there and you get kind of bored and I would make self-portraits of myself with my camera. So I have a picture of myself reading this book. But in any case, what occurred to me was that the very instruments that I was using to study galaxies could be used for interstellar communication. Right. Now, that was just an engineering consideration, but that was a very exciting thought. That was, if you will, even a romantic thought. And so I got interested in it then. I actually joined the SETI Institute only when I moved to the Bay Area, and that was about 1990, actually.
Okay, and by the way, those of you listening, and you have the ability via computer and FastBlast, in our last hour during the phone calls with Stanton and Seth, I'm going to open up your decision-making as the judge, and you're going to fast-blast me with who you think might have won part of this debate. And, in theory, there are no winners or losers, but I do want to get your impressions. So as you listen, and when I announce that toward the last hour, fast-blast me, and I'll add them all up by hand, and I'll try to get the results by the end of the hour. Stanton and Seth, let's chat between you two for just a moment, if we can. We're coming up to the break in about 4 minutes. Seth, why do you not believe? I mean, here you are out there listening for sounds and signals from intelligent life. Why can't you believe the fact that maybe we've been visited by these same people?
Well, actually, I could believe it. That actually isn't the issue. I could believe it. I could believe it. And if someone were to suggest, well, you know, Earth has been giving off a signal that there's life here for 2 billion years, which it has, because there's been a lot of oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere for something like 2 billion years, and that could be detected by essentially anybody in the galaxy, right, with a big enough telescope and the right equipment. And maybe they sent an expedition, you know, 100 million years ago to visit the Earth and found a few dinosaurs and, who knows, stuffed them into sample jars or whatever, took some of their DNA, made a few photos and left. I mean, of course that's possible. That's possible, right? Interstellar travel is not impossible. Doesn't violate physics. Could have been done. But on the other hand, yeah, that would be very difficult to prove. Now, if you're going to make the claim that, well, no, wait a minute, they've not only, they have visited us in modern times, actually within our lifetimes, they've done that. Well, that's a very interesting claim. But if they've done that within our lifetime, then there must be some evidence. There must be some compelling evidence. And I honestly do not believe that that evidence is very compelling. And in fact, in that opinion, I seem to be on the side of, well, let's say, for example, science museums. If you go into your local science museum, they don't have too much on alien visitation, even though everybody would be terribly interested in that. Now, why is it that they don't have that? Well, what are they going to show? What is the evidence? And that's where I get hung up, because if you're going to say that they're here, doggone it, that evidence ought to be fairly irrefutable.
Yes, it is.
Well, I think it is refutable. In fact, it's to me like the Indians of North America having some doubts in 1492 that European ships were visiting our continent. They didn't have those doubts. The Spaniards didn't sail back and forth 3 miles offshore for 57 years teasing the Indians. The Indians knew that they were here.
Well, the evidence is indeed absent, if you will, from the books on SETI. There's no question. And I would agree with you that most museums don't carry any evidence about flying saucers. Part of the problem, of course, is the laughter curtain, the fear of ridicule that keeps scientists from wanting to get involved.
No, 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 Stanton. This is the most interesting thing that could be discovered. Fear of
ridicule
doesn't fly. I don't buy that.
Well, I have talked to many scientists who say, you can't use my name. I wouldn't dare to let my name used if I were to handle a sample like we briefly touched on. We'll talk about more later.
Sure.
But beyond that, look at the references at the back of your books, at Carl Sagan's books, at Drank's books. There's no indication they've looked at any of the large-scale scientific studies. In Demon-Haunted World, Carl Sagan's last real book, his main source of information about UFOs, and he touches on the subject throughout, and I deal with this in a chapter in my book, Top Secret Magic, M-A-J-I-C, his main source of information seems to be Weekly World News. He doesn't talk about Project Blue Book Special Report 14, a large-scale scientific study done by Battelle Memorial Institute. It's as if it didn't exist, and it was under Air Force contract, not ufology contracts, if you will. People talk about the Condon Report. You do in your, not the current book, Cosmic Country. Is that right?
Yep. That's the name of it. Exactly.
Yeah. In your previous book, you mentioned the Condon Report, but you don't mention that a special UFO subcommittee of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics says one could come to the opposite conclusions on the basis of the data in the report from those of Dr. Condon. Any phenomena with 30% unexplained cases is certainly worthy of further study.
Stay with us, Stanton and Seth Shostak, Stanton Friedman. And when we come back, we're going to kind of sit in on their table discussion here, our debate. Perhaps it's like joining them with a cup of coffee, or in my case, a glass of iced tea. And we'll sit down and we'll listen to Stanton and Seth talk about the possibility of UFOs, visitations, and life in outer space. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, our UFO debate. I'm George Norrie, along with Stanton Friedman and Seth Shostak, our very special guests. By the way, thanks to both of you for having the guts to debate each other and to talk and have the dialogue here. A lot of guests would shy away from going at it with another, and it's good to have you both on.
Thanks. We should mention that Seth and I met each other on the Queen Elizabeth II.
Oh, really?
Each listened to the other's lectures. So we had a chance to, you know, find out something about the other person and realize we're not ogres, we don't have horns on the head.
Well, first of all, you're both good people, and I think what is really exciting is you both believe in extraterrestrial life. It's just the difference on if it's here or not. And
wasn't able to finish with the bottom of the hour there, but two areas. Seth, in his latest book, Cosmic Company, says how come they haven't landed and why aren't they seen on radar, when in fact Ted Phillips in Missouri has over the last, 35 years, collected more than 5,000 landing trace cases. These are not crop circles, let me immediately state that, from 75 countries. So they have landed often and in a lot of different places. And he doesn't talk, it's as if the radar cases didn't exist, but the multiple witness radar visual sightings, such as those investigated by Dr. James E. McDonald, the professor of physics, upper atmosphere was his bag, at the University of Arizona, the multiple witness radar visual sightings are some of the most exciting ones, because you got guys on the ground, guys in the sky, radar on the ground, radar in the sky, and behavior that clearly indicates manufactured objects behaving in ways that the things we can manufacture can't duplicate. Therefore, they were made someplace else. That's important evidence, and it's part of the cosmic Watergate business, in the sense that the government certainly doesn't like talking about the military cases. So if we're going to talk about there is no evidence, we have to say, except for all that stuff I haven't looked at, which is my biggest objection, my noisiest objection, if you will, to many of the claims by the SETI people about UFOs. They don't refer to the evidence. It's as if it didn't exist. It reminds me of the four basic rules for debunking. This applies to anything, George. Your other guests can use it in other areas. But what the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. If you can't attack the data, attack the people. And do your research by proclamation. Carl Sagan did the same thing. He talked about there are interesting sightings that aren't reliable, which is certainly true. There are reliable sightings that aren't interesting, which is also true. But then he says there are no interesting and reliable sightings, which is clearly false if you look at the data in the Air Force's biggest study. So let's go back to that evidence. And, you know, one thing that bothers a lot of people is this question of why would aliens come here? And there are many different versions of, you know, why would all the basket makers in the neighborhood come to Earth, mm-hmm. and things like that. But Seth, as an astronomer, knows that there is something special happening here. For everybody in the neighborhood, soon Earthlings will be leaving if we don't destroy ourselves first. And I'm not laying odds either way on that one.
Right, yeah.
But if you were in the local neighborhood, you'd be concerned about this primitive society whose major activity was tribal warfare. When you look at the progress we've made, progress in quotes, in the past 100 years in technology, Seth knows that his radio telescopes are how much better now than they were 40 years ago in terms of how many different channels can be looked at the same time, you know, the speed of computation, all this sort of thing, incredible improvement. So I would think everybody would be concerned about making sure we don't go out there with our brand of friendship, which is hostility. And I don't worry about long. Seth, in his book, not the last one, but the one before, says it's very unlikely that they'll be within that our neighbors, if you will be within hundreds of light years. How can you say unlikely unless you got a catalog of where everybody is? It's not a scientific statement. It has no basis. It's a proclamation.
Well, I'll tell you what we're going to do. Seth, I'm going to sit back a little bit, sit at the table. Stanton, by the way, is the one with the beard. Seth is the other one on the right-hand side of the table. And, Seth, I want you and Stanton just to chat a little bit, and we're just going to kind of listen in on both of you, if that's okay.
All right. Well, let me try this. Stanton has brought up about 12 different points there. And I'd like to address actually what I think is the crux of the matter when it comes to the matter of visitation, because that is, after all, Stanton's bag. Okay, he's convinced they're visiting, and I think that's great because I think that if that's true, then Stanton's in line for a Nobel Prize.
Why?
And I think that because he claims that it's so, and not many other people do. With a master in physics degree, it's rather hard. And so what I want to ask him, and all the rest of this stuff about how close they might be, we'll get back to that if you want,
okay.
Stanton, because I don't think they know we're here. And as far as our aggressive behavior, we always like to talk about our aggressive behavior. In 100 years, we'll still be talking about our aggressive behavior. It's not clear to me that any of that may or may not interest the aliens. I think that's a very self-centered point of view. We always like to think that we're the most important generation. But let me get back to this, because if you talk about the possibility that we're being visited today, or 57 years ago, whatever, and you ask a scientist that, most scientists, in particular, I asked a British astrophysicist once, and what he said to me was this. He said, look, Seth, if I thought that there was a 1% chance that that was true, I would spend 100% of my time working on it. And he isn't. Now, what I would put to Stanton is this. Give me your best case. Don't quote these old reports from, many years ago. I'm glad that they're out there. And, in fact, none of them seems to have convinced the scientific community. So that suggests that something's missing in those reports, and the reports aren't being made today. It doesn't seem. You don't have big teams of academics that are writing big reports. So my question to you is, look, bottom line, tell me the best evidence you have that we're being visited today.
Seth, you just said something that's quite extraordinary. Because the academic community isn't looking at it, that means it doesn't exist.
No.
1% probability? How many of the people who make those claims have studied any of the evidence? I don't mean the tabloid stuff now.
I don't think tabloids
are not a good source of information on any subject.
But they don't all have to study it for it to become accepted as
there
true.
There have been a dozen PhD theses done. I give credit to those professors who did.
Well, Stanton, answer my question. What's the best evidence? Give me your best evidence.
The best evidence is the cumulative effort of lots and lots of people, the Condon Report, Project Blue Book Special Report 14, the congressional testimony of a dozen scientists, including Carl Sagan, incidentally, the book UFO Evidence by Richard Hall, which has hundreds of good cases. Look, you see, saucer events, if you will, sightings in the same bag as astrophysical theory or practice. We're talking about behavior involving intelligence. We're not talking about reproducible laboratory situations. We're talking about something much close to, let's say, murder, automobile accidents, aircraft crashes, where you can't reproduce, where you have to study after the fact. And that's what we have to do with flying saucers. No, I can't bring an alien into the laboratory. Sure wish I could. We wouldn't be having this discussion.
Can you bring a saucer into the laboratory?
What?
You've said there have been thousands of landings.
Yes, and I have done laboratory testing on soil affected by
soil.
Flying
saucers. What about the saucers? What are the best pictures of a landed saucer?
I don't have any pictures of landed saucers. I've got lots of pictures.
There have been thousands of landings, and nobody thought to take a picture?
I've talked to a cop who was standing outside his vehicle in Northern California. Saucer went right over the vehicle, and he told me very sheepishly, he said, look, I always have a camera in the car, because of accidents and things like that. All I was concerned with is, what the heck is this thing doing? After it went by, why didn't I take a picture? Now, we have plenty of pictures at a more reasonable distance where there's no, let's say, immediate threat. There are gun camera pictures. There's some at the National Archives. We have the kind of evidence that you'd expect if you're dealing with intelligently controlled craft doing things under their control. They're not landing in the middle of, let's say, Yankee Stadium. I'm a Dodger fan. Let's say Los Angeles, the Dodger Stadium, so that everybody can watch and yell, get your cameras ready, guys. Here they come. That's not the kind of thing we're dealing with. That's why astronomers, in many ways, are much less well-equipped than police officers to deal with reports, evidence, testimony. 90% of court cases are decided by evidence, evaluation of testimony, when you don't have, first-hand witness, the Lacey Peterson case, the O.J. Simpson case. How different they would be if we had firsthand.
Actually, in the Lacey Peterson case, you have physical evidence, and that's what I'm asking you for.
Not who did what to whom when.
Wait a minute. My question was, Just give me your best. We want to convince this astrophysicist who says, you know,
I don't want to convince an astrophysicist. Why should I? He is concerned about astrophysics.
What about our listeners? Tell our listeners then. They're the jury tonight. Tell them what is your best case. What's the best evidence?
Pick out one case? Let's take a multiple
witness no best case?
Radar visual sighting down and off the Gulf of Mexico. Got the crew of a military airplane. They see this strange thing, if you will. I'll call it a UFO. What the heck? That's the easiest way. They see this on their radar. They see it visually. Guys on the ground say, you know, what's that up there? We see it on the radar. And it circles around. It does all kinds of things. This lasts for an hour. What am I supposed to do with that? Say these guys are all crazy. No, I can't say that. Look at the best cases involving military pilots. Look at NARCAP. I don't know whether George has had Ted Rowe and Dick Haynes of NARCAP on.
I don't think I have.
National Aviation Reporting Center for Anomalous Phenomena. They're headquartered on the West Coast, and they collect reports from pilots, almost all of whom are very wary of being identified because they know what happens to people who I say that they've had a UFO sighting. Nobody's going to fly my airline is sort of the approach. What am I supposed to do with these guys? Say, hey, you're not an astrophysicist. That's silly. In Sky and Telescope, there was an article saying the best witnesses for UFOs would be amateur astronomers. They're familiar with what goes on in the sky. And I say, baloney. I'm in an airplane. I want that pilot to know about things moving around in the sky. I don't care if he knows about a comet going by a few hundred million miles away. I want him to know about things moving under intelligent control. That's what we're talking about here, where we can't control it.
Okay, so Stanton, the answer, if I can summarize your answer here, is that the best evidence is witness testimony by lots of people.
Plus the physical trace cases, the 5,000. Now, I had tests done on soil from Delphos, Kansas, 25 years ago.
And what was in the soil that you couldn't find in some soil elsewhere?
That much, much higher levels of soluble minerals in the soil that was in a ring.
Soluble minerals, you want to tell me what that is?
Calcium, sodium, all the normal stuff that's in soil. However,
calcium, sodium, there's plenty of that in any soil out in my garden.
Now, wait a minute, Seth. They ran tests on the affected soil, the soil in the ring, and control samples from nearby. The soil, the affected soil, would not support plant growth. The normal soil, put seeds, treat the soil samples the same.
That's Stanton.
Seeds grow fine in. We have a higher level of soluble minerals. How do you explain that in a ring 10 feet in diameter, outer diameter?
Well, I could take a carton. I could take a carton of Morton salt outside, make a ring 10 feet in diameter, and nothing would grow in it. And if you did an analysis, you would have soluble salts. You would have it. So that's easy to do.
If you look at the specifics of the case, there's no
way
tell
me what they are, Stan.
Could affect the soil down 14 inches in a ring a little over a foot wide, 10 feet in outer diameter, compared to soil that was nearby. You're going to give them a special ray gun to treat that soil?
No, you give them a bucket and you dissolve some water in it and you pour it. It's pretty straightforward.
The soil won't absorb moisture. Glad you mentioned water, Seth. When you compare the two samples, and I use slides of this in my life.
It won't absorb moisture.
The ring soil won't absorb any moisture. The normal soil makes instant mud. Now, this doesn't happen just once. It happens all over the world. There is a consistent picture of people seeing strange craft, strange to us anyway, sitting on the ground and then taking off. And after the craft is gone, there are physical effects on the soil. Sometimes there are footprints. Sometimes it's dried out. Like I say, down 14 inches, it's a pretty neat trick to do that, especially in a place that gets quite ample rain and on a farm. So there are lots of these cases.
Okay,
There's a whole fat report, half inch thick, if you will.
Wait, hang on there, Stan. So let me summarize where we are now. The best evidence is witness testimony, photos made from great distance. I don't know if you consider that part of the best evidence, and some salty soil samples. Am I right so far?
Well, you've left out the radar visual cases.
Wait a minute. The radar
scientific studies that the SETI specialist refused to look at.
By the way.
You've left out all the relevant evidence. Instead, you've got a sort of comic book picture of what flying saucers are all about. some nut out in the field seeing some crazy thing happening and then running off to the local newspaper, look what I saw. That's not what ufology is about.
It's not what I said either. And in fact, by the way, to say that the SETI specialist refused to look at it, I think is a completely unjustified charge. You don't look at our SETI experiments. Everything you write about
SETI... I look at your SETI stuff. You guys don't... How can you in your book say... How come they haven't landed when they have?
No.
How come you
can say why aren't
they seen on radar when they have been many times?
No, all you look at in our SETI work is when we talk about UFOs. You don't look at our SETI experiments, and yet you blame the SETI experiments, the SETI experimenters, the SETI researchers, for not looking at your UFO evidence. Now, are you checking
out... They make proclamations about the absence of evidence.
And you make proclamations about SETI. I have one right in front of me here. You want me to quote it to you?
Sure.
Okay, it says here... This SETI specialist saying, we'll build some radio telescopes and listen for signals. And undoubtedly, once the signals have gone out far enough, because of course they wouldn't know, they being the aliens, wouldn't know that we're here until they picked up our signals. Well, you all know that Columbus waited to get a smoke signal from the Indians before he set off on his voyages of exploration. Well,
many SETI specialists have said they won't know we're here.
Yeah, exactly. I just said that. I said they won't know we're here, but this is a complete misreading of what SETI does. It sounds like, well, SETI is waiting for our signals to reach putative civilizations and then for them to broadcast in our direction. That's clearly untrue.
No, okay. What it's saying is that SETI specialists don't think they will know we're here until they've picked up our signals.
Which specialists are those?
Well, Lawrence Maxwell Krauss says that.
Who? Maxwell Krauss wasn't with
it. The new Carl Sagan, according to Case Western Reserve University, he wrote...
You don't mean Lawrence Krauss, do you?
What?
You mean Lawrence Krauss?
Yes, Lawrence Krauss at the Case Western Reserve in Cleveland.
Ding, yeah. Ding, 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 ding. That's round one. Break it up, guys. We'll be back with Stanton Friedman and Seth Shostak in a moment with round two of the Great Debate. And then in the third hour, your phone calls and... Also, remember now, those of you by your computer, in the third hour, I'll ask you to fast blast me and tell me who you think may have won the debate. And we're going into round two now with the debate between Stanton Friedman, the father of modern-day ufology, and Seth Shostak from SETI. They took some pretty big punches in that first round. As a matter of fact, Stanton threw a few big ones in the beginning. Seth came wallowing back. Then the bell rang. So we'll see who's standing. They're rested now. And by the way, Paul in Philadelphia writes, George, there's no way I'm going to get any sleep tonight. These two are great. What a show. I don't know how I'll get to work tomorrow. And he's probably right. So just stay up. We'll be back in a moment with Seth Shostak and Stanton Friedman as we get their views, their opinions on life in space and whether it's come here. And during the commercial break, of course, Seth and Stanton were on the floor punching each other. I had to jump in and break it. I'm only kidding. I'm having fun listening to you two talk about this topic. I'll turn you both loose again a little bit later on this hour as we continue this dialogue. Seth, give me an update, by the way, on SETI. What's going on with the Paul Allen array? That's not online yet, is it?
It's not online yet. No, the Allen Telescope Array, which is under construction here in Northern California and will be the first, large radio telescope actually designed to do SETI searches and also to do, in fact, radio astronomy research, is under construction. And the first 32 elements of that is 32 antennas, because it is an array. It will ultimately consist of hundreds of antennas. The first 32 will be operational this fall, and we'll be starting a survey of the galactic plane, which is to say, what you see with your eye is the Milky Way, and it pays to scan that part of the sky first because, of course, there's a very high density of stars in those directions. So that will begin this fall.
How many blips have we gotten so far through SETI where you guys went, oh, my, we might have something, and then you realize later on, no, you did not?
Well, you get signals all the time. When we were observing at Arecibo, the telescope down in Puerto Rico that many people will know from the movies, in particular Contact, we would get, on the average, several signals every minute, actually more like five or six per minute, okay? And all of those get checked out. Many of them are automatically checked out by the software because the software knows the characteristics of a signal that's truly coming from space as opposed to being as opposed to coming from a transmitter that's bolted to the Earth. And but, you know, usually a couple of times a night you'll get a signal that requires further checking. So, you know, a couple of times a night you get a signal that looks interesting enough to spend a little bit, a few more minutes of telescope time to track it down. But in terms of how often you get a signal that keeps your interest up for hours, that's very, very rare. Only every couple of years do you get a signal that, that takes hours to track down.
Stanton, some researchers in the field of ufology think that what these could be might be dimensional visitors, time travelers. You are more apt to believe that they are physical beings from regions throughout this universe, right?
Well, not throughout the universe. I only worry about the local neighborhood.
Right.
But no, I have not jumped into the fourth-dimensional space-time warping, 11-dimensional spring string theory or anything like that. I will say this. It doesn't matter to me, really, how they get here. In other words, whether they are warping space and time or using a fusion rocket such as the ones I worked on 40-some years ago. They're here. They're from someplace else. We got manufactured articles behaving in ways that we can't duplicate. They must have been manufactured someplace else. Pretty straightforward. but the real kicker here on both SETI and ufology is recognition of the fact that technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. There isn't the slightest reason to expect that an advanced civilization, and you can define that any way you want, 200 years ahead of us, 2,000, 2 million, 2 billion, it's not going to be doing things the way we do. And we shouldn't expect that we should be able to say what the best means of long-distance communication is for a society that's, let's say, even a modest 1,000 years ahead of us. That's one of the problems that I see. We're listening for radio signals. We could have been looking for smoke signals 150 years ago. But we know, and, you know, I'll keep looking around for slide rules, but I guess nobody's doing any calculations because I don't see any slide rules.
Well, are you glad, Stanton, that there is a program like SETI in effect now?
Well, SETI as a means of two things come to mind. One is the wonderful work that's been done with using home computers.
Yes.
Distributed computations. There's a fancier word than that for it, but I think that's great that we're taking advantage of an awful lot of unused computational skills, and I'm sure there are other areas in which that approach to doing things would be very helpful. Secondly, there's no question that radio telescopes are a window on the universe, and it's an awful big universe, and we're awful ignorant. So I like to think that that is a sensible thing to do, and after all, the budgets are modest. We're not talking huge amounts of money. Seth was talking about the Hat Creek Observatory. What total cost? Under $150 million, right, Seth?
Much less than that.
Yeah. Okay, that's peanuts. Look, when I was working on nuclear airplanes, we were spending $100 million a year in 1958, which tells you something about the mindset of the people who spend money. I'm not saying that was a good or bad investment. It was fascinating work. But what I'm saying is that technology to be new, developing new technology is a good thing. But the notion that we already know how aliens are going to communicate or how they're going to travel is something else, or how they're going to behave. And it's been my observation that SETI people seem to think they have the inside track on how aliens would behave and on what their technology would be. And I say there's no reason for saying that at all. Seth has mentioned astrophysicists. There weren't any astrophysicists working on the nuclear rockets when I was working on them, or on the fusion rockets, or on nuclear airplanes.
What about Freeman Dyson? He headed up the project. Freeman Dyson is an astrophysicist.
What?
Freeman Dyson? Does that mean anything to you?
He wasn't. Of course it does. But he wasn't working on the large-scale programs.
Oh,
he worked
a little bit
on the
Nuclear propulsion.
Yeah, but not the big nuclear propulsion programs. He was looking at
Project Orion. Wasn't a big one? I thought it was.
No, it wasn't. Like I said, we were spending $100 million on nuclear airplanes in 58. The nuclear rocket
This was a nuclear rocket. But this is a bit beside the point, because I think that what Stanton is trying to say here, and if I paraphrase you incorrectly, Stanton, I'm sure you'll correct me,
yep.
is that SETI is making a mistake in its approach because it's assuming that radio is a means of communication that extraterrestrials might use.
Am I correct? It's assuming it's the only means of communication.
No, but that's false, Stanton, because it isn't the only way we search. All right? You're clearly...
You've got optical SETI, too. Okay, I'll buy into optical. That's an indication we're aware that somebody could build lasers that we could observe from here, which is kind of neat.
Okay, so what techniques would you suggest that we should be using that we're not?
I'm saying I have no idea what aliens would use, and you guys don't either.
No, but
because a cop finds a man who's crawling on his hands and knees under a traffic light, and he says, "What are you doing down there?" "I'm looking for my keys." "Well, where'd you lose them?" "Well, over there." "What are you looking over here for?" "The light's better here." Because the tools that they have to listen for radio signals has nothing to do with whether anybody out there is stuck at the level of radio.
Yes, but Stanton, that's a very peculiar kind of argument, because the suggestion that we should look for, if I can use this term, electromagnetic radiation, in other words, radio or light, as a signaling device, is based on the physics we know. The physics we know, and this is a high school physics calculation, in fact, will prove to you that radio, in fact, is the least expensive way of sending a bit of information from one star system to the next. It's the most efficient way. It's the least expensive in terms of the energy required.
And that we know about.
Well, yes, indeed, you're quite right. There could be all sorts of physics that we don't know about that might allow you to do this some other way. But you can't do an experiment with physics you don't know. I hate to point that out, but it is true. And it's also a bit analogous to telling Chris Columbus, you know, forget these wooden ships. You're never going to discover anything like that. Why don't you sit around for 500 years? And they'll invent jet planes, and you can cross the Atlantic in 6 hours eating bad meals.
You could also say,
you could do that, but
why are you going over there? You haven't had any signal from them to indicate there's anybody there.
But that was something you were saying before the hour, that SETI is predicated on the idea that they will know about us and consequently signal back. But that is not a SETI premise. You mentioned, Michael Krauss. You met Lawrence Krauss at Case Western Reserve. Lawrence Krauss is the head of the physics department at Case Western Reserve. I happen to know the guy. He's not a SETI scientist, and I've never heard him say that. Who in the SETI community has said that?
That what? They won't?
That we should wait until our signals get there before we have any hope of hearing anything from them.
No, he didn't say we should wait. He said they wouldn't know, for example.
Well, that's his opinion. That's fine. But he's not a SETI researcher, and you said that this is a SETI assumption. And I have to challenge that, because you say a lot of misleading things about SETI, and I'm sorry, but I do have to challenge that.
Are you saying that SETI is not assuming that they are using radio?
I'm assuming
optical?
They're using radio, but I'm not assuming that they've picked up any of our radio, because, after all, our radio signals have only been going out for about 50 or 60 years since we've been able to generate high-powered, high-frequency transmissions. Well, within 50 or 60 light years, there are, as you point out, a few thousand stars. Okay, but on the other hand, if we're going to pick something up, we can only count those stars at maximum half that distance.
Yes, of course.
Okay, and that's one-eighth of the stars. We're talking about a few hundred stars. Well, nobody would do an experiment if they thought, look, our only hope is that there's a civilization somewhere around the nearest couple of hundred stars. That's an extraordinarily small number, and that would mean that there were billions of transmitting civilizations in our galaxy, and as optimistic as I am about the existence of extraterrestrial life, I don't think that there are necessarily billions of transmitting civilizations right now.
If you are interested in extraterrestrial intelligence as opposed to picking up electromagnetic signals, and I'll include optical and radio quite correctly, as you point out, then one should be studying the UFO evidence. We have strange beings.
Well, but
strange
we count on you to do that, Stanton. We count on you to do that. That's your
bad. No, you don't. You ignore what we do.
No, I don't ignore what you do, but I'm asking you, and that was what really was my point in the last hour, was that you tell me, as a skeptic, because I am a skeptic, I mean, that's why we're debating here.
But you're not a debunker.
I'm not a debunker. I'm not out there to debunk you. I just want you to convince me with your best evidence, and so far, what I've heard is testimony by witnesses, which
physical
is...
Physical trace cases.
Yeah, lots of cases, but then, you know, a lot of cases doesn't mean that the testimony is any more convincing. I want, you know, witness testimony, as anybody who goes to a court of law knows, is not always reliable. The second thing is, you say we've got rings of bits of ground that are salty, but of course I could take my bucket of water filled with Morton salt and go create that myself, and you say the ground didn't absorb water. Well, where I grew up in Virginia, the ground didn't absorb water either, but it wasn't due to aliens. It was simply due to clay. I don't find that very convincing. You say that
but
there are
you
a lot
haven't looked at those cases, Seth. You're
well,
making
wait,
generalizations.
Wait, that's true,
water,
but I never claimed to be an investigator.
It has nothing to do with the physical trace cases. You're leaving out, of course, the multiple witness observations of things on
well,
that ground.
Let me ask you both this one. One of the areas that fascinates me, ancient pictures that obviously show something up in the sky that could be UFOs. We'll start with you, Seth, and then I want to get your take, Stanton. Might that be evidence, physical evidence? I mean, what are the odds, let's say, of a 13th century artist creating in his mind a UFO and putting it in a picture over a Madonna or something like that?
Well, there have been, of course, portrayals in the medieval artwork of comets, for example. Halley's Comet is in the Bayeux Tapestry, for example, and that goes back to, I think, 1066, or shortly thereafter, actually. But in any case, sure, there were astronomical events that they would portray. And, you know, you could say, but what about this one? Maybe this wasn't really a comet or a shooting star, you know, a meteor. Maybe this one was actually a visitor from another world. Well, of course, maybe it could be. But that's not going to convince anybody because, of course, it could also have been any of these other things which are somewhat more prosaic, a little less interesting, and consequently that's not, unfortunately, very compelling evidence.
So, what do you think, Stanton, of the old pictures and paintings that show?
They're at best in my gray basket.
Are they?
Certainly
okay.
Some of them we can't say anything about, as Seth pointed. You know, what's a thing in the sky? If it's got a lot of structure to it, we would ask more questions. But, you know, I'd look at the work of Dr. Barry Downing, Bachelor of Physics, Doctor of Divinity, whose book, The Bible in Flying Saucers, goes back to descriptions similar to today's, dating back 2,000-3,000 years. And I find his work very fascinating. He has trouble with the ecumenical community, I might say, who don't want to deal with this either. So I don't put them high on my list of evidence at all. I never talk about those because they're so amenable to interpretation as opposed to, you know, clear-cut examples of something strange.
In your opinion, Stanton, how many other civilizations might there be out there in our vicinity?
I have no idea. I'm particularly fascinated, though, by the pair of stars, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli. And this is to give people a different concept of how the situation can be drastically different in the local neighborhood than it is here. These two stars are a billion years older than the sun. They're both sun-like stars, but they're only an eighth of a light year apart, which means that people on a planet, beings, okay, on a planet around one looking at the other, it's visible almost all day long for most of the people. You could directly observe planets. As Seth knows, within 50 years, we certainly expect to have systems up, hopefully a lot sooner, but you know, I won't be too optimistic about that, that can directly observe planets around other stars. Well, here we have a place that a billion years ago, with only an eighth of a light year separation, would have had far more incentive for interstellar travel than we do. And they're not, you know, hundreds of light years away or thousands of light years away. They're 39 light years away, just down the street.
Why would they have had more incentive for interstellar travel, Stan? I missed
because they got a neighbor close by.
Well, that's true of more than half the stars in the galaxy.
Most of them, you mean double stars?
Yeah.
Well, these aren't a double star. These are only these are 9,000 AU apart. The double star is usually up to 1,000 AU, almost as much as 1,000 AU.
Well, some are and some aren't. I mean, they're very close doubles, and they're very wide doubles. But
these are very wide doubles. I would expect you're going to have more travel when you've got a neighbor than when you're way out in the boondocks, as we are.
Well, you seem to have some insight into alien sociology there, Stanton.
I'm almost as bad as the radio astronomers who think they know how aliens would behave.
I don't know why you say that, but maybe you'll tell me. But in any case, I didn't mean to interrupt you. You were saying about Zeta Reticuli as being the place where they came from, and how do you know that?
Well, the whole notion of the specialness, if you will, speciality, no, specialness of Zeta 1 and Zeta 2, comes out of the Betty and Barney Hill abduction case, and the fact that Betty saw a star map, and that alone doesn't prove anything. But when a woman built a number of three-dimensional models of our local neighborhood and found that the base stars matched the Betty's drawing and they were Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 reticuli, and what's interesting to me is when this work was done, and as you know, the measurement of distances to nearby stars has gotten a heck of a lot better now with the Hipparcos satellite. Then they were only known to be maybe a light year apart. But now with new data, we know that they're 39 light years away instead of 37, but only an eighth of a light year apart. That changes the picture. So I would expect that they were traipsing around, checking out the whole neighborhood, and the kind of system that we will be building within the next 50 years, they could have built a billion years ago. So they would know where all the planets were in the neighborhood. They would go visiting selectively, I suppose. I mean, you can think of a lot of reasons for traveling to Earth, some of them not so nice, but, you know, this is a penal colony. They dumped all the bad boys.
That's why
we're so nasty to each other.
Seth, what about you? How many possible civilizations? I mean, you believe that they're out there. Do you think it could be endless?
Well, no, I don't. Endless may be going too far, literally and figuratively. But there are, you know, several hundred billion stars in our galaxy. There are probably a larger number of planets than there are stars. But, of course, we don't know what fraction of those are habitable, you know, that might cook up life. But the things you really don't know is what fraction of those that might even be habitable have produced intelligence. And it's not just intelligence. It has to be intelligence that's more or less coeval with us. That is to say that they're around more or less at the time that we're around, so that there would be some chance that we might be able to detect them. And the bottom line, how many of them there might be? Well, nobody knows. There are the pessimists who think none, and then they're very optimistic estimates. Carl Sagan's estimate was millions. Okay, so if you take sort of the logarithmic average of all that, so you say, well, we don't really know, but the average of the estimates is on the order of 10,000 in the galaxy.
Wow. Okay.
That's a lot, but that means that the nearest extraterrestrials are about 1,000 light years away, which strikes me as a long way to come just to buzz the countryside.
Right. That's a nice, easy round. We're coming back now for round three. Both of their coaches, by the way, are now saying go for the knockout. We're running out of time. So, Seth, what would happen if you were out there in the fields and you saw UFO land? Would that convince you?
Well, if I saw UFO land, I suspect that would convince me personally, but it might not convince anybody else unless I was able to grab a taillight off it or an ashtray or something like that.
Have you ever seen anything up there that you thought was possibly a UFO?
Well, I've seen, UFO just means it's unidentified. I've seen things in the sky, of course, that I didn't know what they were. In fact, I was driving up the 405, as you call it down there, the San Diego Freeway.
Ah, yes.
you may spend some
time. You mean you could actually drive on it?
Well, actually, I was parked. I was surrounded by sheet metal, and I was parked on the 405, inching forward at about the speed at which continental drift is moving us toward Japan. And I saw something in the distance that I didn't understand. It was in the sky. It was close up to the San Gabriel Mountains, or actually it was above the hills of Hollywood. And I didn't know what it was, but 3 hours later, when I had moved forward about 15 miles, I saw that it was a blimp. And now in that case, I was able to figure out what it was because I was slowly moving, and I got it was persistent, and I got a different view.
Excellent. How about you, Stan? Ever see anything up there unidentified?
Nothing that I would call a flying saucer. Remember, my lectures, flying saucers are real, not UFOs are real. But I need to point out something. Seth just came up with some numbers, 10,000 civilizations in the galaxy, average distance 1,000 light years, and then was nearest one 1,000 light years. That's dartboard physics. We have information on one civilization, if you call this a civilization, and I will for tonight's purposes, in one solar system, and somehow we can extrapolate that for the whole galaxy. And remember that completely excludes colonization and migration. So if one civilization got started and planted colonies hither, thither, and yon, the SETI calculations don't take that into account at all.
Wait,
numbers on a dartboard, throw a dart. We have 10,000 civilizations. Somebody else does it. Today's number is 1,000,000 civilizations. That's silly. We got 200 billion. What's a good number, Seth? How many stars in the galaxy?
Well, actually, maybe 400 billion. But, you know, actually, Stanton, there may be an occupation for you in hospice care because you're very good at putting things in my mouth, in particular words.
You just said 10,000 civilizations, right?
No.
Have at it, guys. By the way, 14 minutes to go. Have at it. This is the last round. Well, you might as well both go for the knockout. Have fun.
Okay, well, I'll let Stanton finish his swing here, and then I'll finish my thought.
What I'm saying is that there have been a myriad of calculations about how many civilizations in the galaxy, using the Drake equation as kind of a basis for that. But there's no science supporting the Drake equation. We have no way of knowing what fraction of stars have planets and what fraction of those planets develop life and what the lifespan is, which, of course, is a crucial number in the Drake equation calculation. I'm saying if we look at the evidence, there's no reason to say they're not 39 light years away from here, that there may be bases, the equivalent of gas stations, if you will, throughout our local neighborhood. We're the most behind, if there is such a term, system in the neighborhood, for all I know. So the 10,000 number has no validity at all. And to say that the nearest one is 1,000 light years away is silly. When I lived in the Bay Area, I once calculated the average distance to the 10 largest metropolitan areas in the country was like 1,500 miles. But the nearest one was 20 miles away.
Okay.
So average distances don't mean anything.
Well, Stan, let me just take that on a bit before you go on further there, because actually what happened was that George asked me for an estimate of how many civilizations might be in the galaxy, and I said, well, nobody knows, of course. And indeed, that's the point of SETI, is to try and find out something. Now, to say that the Drake equation is a complete guess and we don't know how many stars have planets and so forth, well, that's not true. We have some indication. We have lower limits on what fraction of stars have planets because we've been finding planets. We found more than 100 of them.
Yep.
So we have some statistics there. But we don't know how many civilizations are out there. That's quite true. And if you just look at the range of guesses, and they are guesses, that have been published, you have from one Earth, that's it, to, as I say, Carl Sagan said millions.
Yep.
And that's kind of the range of guesses. And I said, so the average of that is on the order of 10,000, which would mean that the nearest civilization is 1,000 light years away. And you could be right. Maybe the nearest civilization is 39 light years away. But that's not the issue now, is it? The issue is, do we have the evidence for that? SETI differs from ufology in this very crucial point. That is, if we don't claim that we have found ET, you do, we don't. If we do make that claim, if we say we have found a signal, there won't be a debate about it here on Coast to Coast AM, much as that would be an interesting thing to do. What would happen is that everybody with a radio telescope and every other kind of telescope would be able to point in the direction of this thing because the evidence would be in the sky. No cover-up, don't have to worry about those nefarious feds freeze-drying and stacking up the evidence somewhere. Mind you, apparently every other country has done the same thing. I don't quite know how they've done that.
They all have a common interest in doing that, of course.
Well, they do, don't they? I mean, the Bolivians have covered it up, and the Iraqis and the Paraguayans and the Bulgarians. By gosh, either that or only, you know, the aliens only land in the U.S. for some peculiar reason. But that wouldn't be the case in the instance of a SETI detection. Everybody with a telescope could verify whether what we were saying was true or not. That's the difference. And that's a very important difference. So I'm just trying to understand your...
But remember, Seth, that would... what if the civilization died 1,000 years ago? The signals could still be coming out, couldn't they?
Of course they could be. And in fact, I could read Julius Caesar, and Julius Caesar died 2,000 years ago. Doesn't mean he didn't exist. So what?
Well, what I'm saying is you don't know whether what you're receiving is a signal from an, let's say, an ongoing civilization as of the time the signal was sent. It could have been left there as a beacon, you know, for whatever purpose, or
right.
Because somebody destroyed somebody else, and whoops, oh well, let it go.
That's perfectly fine with me, Stanton. I have no problem with that. Then we've discovered the beacon. The point is, it was built by some sort of thinking beings, and that's
the
only point.
So are the vehicles that are coming here, Seth?
Well,
so we're the vehicles that are coming here,
all right,
and then leave. We've got big ones, we got small ones, we got fast ones, we got slow ones. The military has been chasing them for ages. Talk to the pilots. I hope that George will have somebody from NARCAP on who will talk about more than 1,000 reports that they have.
I will do that.
Well,
from
Stanton,
pilots, because...
Stanton, it sounds like you sound like a used car salesman. We got big ones, we got small ones, we got them in all sizes. since you are convinced that they're here, and I'm trying to summarize the evidence over the past hour and a half, 2 hours and a half now.
That was a below-the-belt hit, by the way, Seth. That will be not allowed.
Okay. There's nothing wrong with used car sales, by the way. I have relatives that do that. But I'm trying to summarize the evidence that you presented so far, and that is you admit anecdotal, and we've got rings of salt on the ground, and you said there have been radar sightings. Now, of course, radar sightings.
Radar visual cases, Seth. There's a difference between that and saying, oh, there's a blip on radar. Oh, my God.
Okay,
my
so,
God,
so, we, so we have.
Spacecraft. That's not what we're talking about.
Okay, so we have the radar saying. Now, let me ask you this, because this to me is, I think, a very important point. If you talk about astronomy research, and that's, after all, sort of the game I've been in for a while, we learn things. We have new knowledge all the time. In 1947, if you ask, well, what do we know about planets around other stars? And the answer was, not much. In fact, zip. We had some ideas about what they might be like, but we didn't know anything. Now we know quite a bit, actually. All right? There's been an advance in knowledge. Now, you're claiming that aliens somehow came at least 39 light years. Let's say 39 light years, and that's, about 220 trillion miles. Okay, they came, and then in the last 500 feet somewhere over Roswell, New Mexico, they made a navigation error and crashed. They didn't have any problem with the 200.
That's not at all what I'm saying, Seth. That's why I mentioned big ones and small ones. There's no reason at all to assume that what crashed in Roswell and out near the plains of San Augustine just came here from Zeta Reticuli on its own. We have aircraft carriers that carry 75, 80 small aircraft that work by entirely different principles, that look entirely different, and behave entirely different. We have motherships,
Stanton, what you're saying is that there might be a whole variety of visitors here. So my next question, and this is, I think, an important question, is in 57 years of being visited, what have we learned? What do we know that we wouldn't have known if they hadn't been visiting? Has there been any benefit? If you had asked the Indians of North America 57 years after Columbus visited them whether the fact that Europeans were visiting them had any influence on their civilization, by God, it did. In fact, most of them were dead by then. Okay, it had a tremendous influence. I want to know, what have we learned?
We Earthlings have learned that we're not alone in the universe, the neighborhood, if you want to call it whichever you will. We have learned that there are techniques for flight that are very different from what we have, much more effective from a military viewpoint, one of the reasons for secrecy, obviously. We'd sure like to be able to duplicate the
Give me a fact, Stan.
We've learned that governments are quite capable of keeping secrets over long periods of time. We've learned that we need to try to figure out why we are so concerned about the governments are so concerned about releasing information, why the NSA and the CIA have continually withheld information about UFOs. These are important things to learn.
Yeah, but is there any fact I can put in? I can put in a textbook.
In God's creation, if I can, pardon the phrase, but you know what I mean. But somebody's coming here. They obviously know more astronomy and more nuclear physics than we do.
Well, good. But have we learned any of that?
Why would you share your secrets with a primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare?
Convenient. Isn't that too convenient, Stan? You've got to admit, that's awfully convenient. Doggone it, they came here, but really the best evidence is being secreted away. And, yes, they know a lot of things that we would like to know, but doggone it, they don't want to tell us.
Why would they want to? Do you give children, young children, guns to play with? They do in Texas. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have asked the question that way. But why would an advanced civilization share its secrets with a primitive society?
So
I know that Morrison has said, as soon as we hook up on the intragalactic radio network, they will transmit to us the secrets of the universe. Why? Nobody in his right mind would give us advanced technology. We're not to be trusted with what we've got. I mean, look, you're saying let's say less than $100 million a year on radio telescope, radio astronomy. And collectively on this planet, we'll spend $1 trillion this year on things military. I don't know what the latest number is because it's kind of a moving target, because we are concerned with targets rather than with people and learning about the universe. There's a big disparity there is what I'm saying. So we have to take things as they are. They're coming here. They don't seem to want to land in the middle of any big stadium. The government knows they're coming here. I've talked to loads of former military people who have been involved in multiple witness, radar visual cases, lots of communication. Four airplanes going up, three coming back after UFOs. Uncorrelated targets, that's the fancy word. We can't say UFO into the military. Clearly indicate that there's a lot of stuff going on that the public doesn't hear about. By definition, that data is born classified. We don't get weekly reports how many times we scrambled jets after UFOs. Let me give one comment, a quote from a government document. General Carol Bolander, whose memo back in 1969 was responsible for the closure of Project Blue Book in agreement with the Condon Committee's recommendations earlier that year, he's talking about they haven't contributed anything to science, and I'm not disagreeing with him there. Then he says, reports of UFOs which could affect national security are not part of the Blue Book system. And he repeats it when he says the Blue Book is closed, the public doesn't have a place to report. However, as previously noted, reports which could affect national security will continue to be investigated with the procedures set up for that purpose. That's JNAP 146 and Air Force Manual 55-11. Now, what does that mean? I talked to General Bolander. No question. If there are sightings, for example, at a SAC base of saucers moving down the runway where nuclear weapons are stored, that's of national security interest. What you and I see standing out on the street corner, or even on the 405, crawling along the 405, is really of far less interest. So there's a real world out there, and there's the artificial world set up by the noisy negativists, as I call them, that ignores all the implications of all of this stuff.
Well, so, Stan, if I understand you here, you know, is that the best evidence is being secreted away.
2 minutes to go, John.
And we haven't learned anything. So in that case,
we have learned a great deal. Knowing that we're not alone is a you would certainly say.
Well, yes,
is a very
you convinced me of that
knowledge.
Because the evidence isn't very good. So I don't consider that I've learned something. If you would tell me something about the Zeta Reticuli system that I could go out and verify with my telescope, you'd have me convinced. They haven't done that.
Check and see what their separation is, Seth, and then
tell me.
I know that there are people looking for planets, but the last time I checked, they hadn't yet come in with their report.
That's pretty small beer there. But let me just reiterate the fact that okay, the evidence is kind of poor because the best evidence is held from our eyes, and we haven't learned anything. So it sounds to me like the argument for UFOs is an argument from ignorance. It's an argument from the lack of information because the aliens don't want to tell us anything interesting, and the government has managed in some sort of unprecedented efficiency to hide all the best evidence. Well, in that case, I guess maybe what we ought to declare is that, yep, the UFOs really are real. They're all alien spacecraft. But guess what, folks? It has absolutely no effect on your life because they don't want to tell us anything and we haven't learned anything from it.
We've learned a great deal. Maybe our whole space program is based on some knowledge we learned from noting that round, blunt bodies can move very rapidly in the atmosphere, unlike the X-15, the X-1, the high-speed aircraft we thought was the way high-speed vehicles would look. All kinds of things we may have learned, not by saying, hey, this is from Zeta Reticuli, and that one is from
Are you saying that our aircraft reflect alien technology? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying it is quite possible that we have learned a great deal from examination
of wreckage,
say, from Roswell in the plains of San Augustine that hasn't made its way out into the public notion because we don't want our enemies, and let's face it, the United States has been in a Cold War. It's getting a little hotter these days for a long time now. We don't want to tell our enemies what we have learned. We'd like to know what they know. We set up a secret project to try to figure out how the darn things work. Why would you tell anybody about it? You can't tell your friends without telling your enemies, after all.
Well,
they listen to George Noory, too.
Well, Stanton, I made a plot here just recently of the top speed of military aircraft, U.S. military aircraft, as a function of time, from the Wright brothers up to the present time, to see if, after 1947, our top flight military aircraft had more capability. And guess what? It was a smooth curve.
I'm going to break you both up now, guys. That's it. The round is over. Coast with Stanton Friedman, Seth Shostak, and your phone calls this hour. Stanton, let me ask you, though, when you were in Roswell not too long ago, I'm told somebody handed you a piece of metal. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, yeah, much to my surprise, as a panel discussion was going to take place in front of several hundred people, a gentleman came up as somebody I know whose family actually owned the store in Corona, where Mac Brazel, the rancher who was the first to make noise about what was recovered, at the debris field outside Roswell in 1947. He's been going to conferences, and he and another gentleman, Art Campbell, who's been doing a lot of work on the Plains of San Augustine case, happened at about the same time, but way over near where the VLA is now, as a matter of fact. They were screening a bunch of dirt, several square yards of dirt, out where they think the San Augustine crash occurred, and they came up with some pieces of material, it's the best I can say, and I was handed, to my total surprise, and in front of all these people, which is not the way I would have preferred it be done, this piece of metal in a small plastic bag was about 2 inches by 2.5 inches, maybe less than an eighth of an inch thick, didn't weigh much. It was in the plastic bag. There were lots, all these people around. I managed to put it aside and then arrange for it several days later to be shipped to an outstanding testing laboratory, a forensic testing laboratory, which is accustomed to doing all kinds of weird tests on weird materials. And I just today, as a matter of fact, late today, got the first report. I'm waiting for the written report, which will be here tomorrow, indicating that it is aluminum. Now, I should add that when I got this piece of material, I was told that other pieces had been tested and showed 24% silicon. Now, 24% silicon and the rest aluminum is a very peculiar material. No standard aluminum alloys have that much silicon. On the other hand, this piece was dirty, call it muddy-looking. It looked, certainly looked as if it had been underground for a long time. And in talking to the lab director today, it was clear when you cleaned off the dirt that you got rid of just about all that silicon. Silicon is the most common element that you find in dirt, and so it wasn't surprising that mud would have silicon in it. So far, not particularly exciting. Now, we haven't, this is the first public comment I've made since I just heard this today, but there'll be more, and we have to decide, several of us, whether we'll do more tests to see if we can get a specific alloy out of this, if it's a standard, U.S. aluminum alloy, which is used in aircraft and all kinds of stuff, and there are rockets that landed out in that part of the Plains of San Augustine and so forth, then we can certainly rule it out as having any kind of special origin, unless you want to say that aliens came and made their craft out of material we make, which I'm not ready to say at all. So it was intriguing, it was exciting, it was a surprise. I would like to have seen the look on my face when he handed it to me.
All right, let's go to the calls. And when I go to you, if you would direct your call to either Stanton or Seth, if you would. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, my name's Chris.
Hi, Chris.
I'm from Tulsa, Oklahoma. My comment is addressed to Seth, but I would like Stanton to hear it as well. Here goes. The anecdotal evidence of UFO sightings is not a few stories. It is a horde that is consistent across the geographical spectrum. Many people who report UFO sightings are perfectly competent citizens, and often land a group of people will see UFOs. I and a couple of friends once saw two unmistakables in 10 minutes. I urge you to view in more detail whatever dozen books Stanton will recommend, and return to the show with your opinions. Also, check Roswell and Blue Book with the two, in the last 10 years, recent, ridiculously obvious false covering press conferences. Look at the details and come back and tell me if you don't see something funny. And I'll hear your replies on the radio. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And go ahead, Seth.
Well, I have nothing to say much to Chris there. He's recommending that I read some books. I've actually read some books. I recommend that he read a book, actually, by Cal Korf on Roswell. Because Cal Korf spent 16 years investigating Roswell. And at the end, he said, and I quote here, the UFO field has suffered in credibility because of Roswell, and especially because of the unprofessional and shoddy standards of evidence the Roswell authors have practiced. He thinks that it's actually doing a disservice to ufology. You might want to read that. But, great, Chris. I hear you.
All right, next up, first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast.
No comment from me.
Oh, do you want to comment on that? Sure.
Yeah, I've read Cal Korf's book, and I've discussed it in one of my MUFON papers, so I totally disagree with Cal's evaluation, but that's another story.
All right, let's go to our first-time caller line. Go ahead. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Yes, I have. First, my questions for statement for both gentlemen.
All right.
You both come from very strong convictions on how you believe. You ever thought about maybe taking aside what you know and then going towards, like Mr. Friedman, study from Seth's point and vice versa, and see if that information can further benefit what you're trying to learn and try to learn further your, I don't want to say experiments, but your, trying to think of a word I'm got people bothering me over here, excuse me, but just try to learn from one another to further your studies.
Well, I would recommend you look at, I have a piece, UFOs Challenge to SETI Specialists, on my website, www.stanfriedman.com,
yes,
and you'll see that I do refer to a lot of the SETI information.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of my complaints about the SETI people, is that they don't refer to the UFO information.
Okay. And, and you both agree that there are aliens, if I came in kind of late in the program, correct?
Well,
let me
respond to that, actually, at the top of the hour. I'm afraid I didn't get your name.
Tim. I'm from Panama City, Florida. Sorry.
Okay, Tim.
Thanks.
At the top of the hour, in fact, George asked us both how we felt about the existence of extraterrestrial intelligence, aliens, if you will. And clearly Stanton believes that they exist because he thinks they're here. But I think that they probably do exist. However, you know, strictly speaking, I'm agnostic. That is to say, until we find evidence that convinces me, then we have to say the question is open. I think it's fairly likely that they're there, and that's why we do this experiment that we call SETI. But until SETI finds something, then I can't say that SETI has proven that they're there.
Okay. Mr. Seth, have you ever gone and interviewed a lot of the folks that have claimed they've seen the UFOs and have done hands-on research with these individuals to maybe try to not just debunk yourself, but to convince yourself otherwise?
Well, honestly, that's not my job, see, so I don't
do
that. But obviously I've talked with Stanton, and one other thing, Tim, I do get about once every couple of weeks, I guess, somebody will call me up and relate to me a story of, UFOs or alien abduction or something, some interference in their personal lives which they think is due to extraterrestrial. So in that sense, I get first-hand reports from people who claim to have had such experiences, yes.
Tim, thanks for your call. So if there was a visitation by UFOs and we all knew it and saw it and witnessed it, would that kill the SETI project or would it still continue?
Well, I think that if aliens really were proven to be here, and, you know, pardon my presumption there, because obviously from my point of view that hasn't been proven, but if that evidence, I thought there was convincing evidence, and, the scientific world, if you will, was convinced by that, I suspect that that would be so overwhelmingly important that the SETI efforts would indeed be, you know, I'm not sure that you would give them the priority that I give them in any case, because clearly, if they're here, that's a lot different than trying to find them very far away.
True. And Stanton, would you agree with that?
It would change things drastically, yeah. And a lot of it would depend on how the evidence was presented. If somebody said they're here and about to destroy us, then forget radio telescopes. Let's see, how do we defend ourselves? If they said they're here, they want to let us know that there's a Galactic Federation, we don't qualify for admission yet, and here's a map showing where all the civilizations are, that might rev up the SETI business if there was a means that they could describe to us that we would pick up their signals. In other words, if it isn't electromagnetic and there's a whole new ball game there, I think SETI specialists would be appropriate for figuring out how to integrate, just as they've gone, to their credit, to the optical SETI program. That didn't exist, seven, 8 years ago, Seth? Something like that.
No, there were experiments actually conducted by the Soviets quite some time ago and others, but indeed it has definitely ramped up in the last half dozen years simply because of the available technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if we find out a new available technology, that might put SETI guys out in the forefront of
setting up a galactic
radio network.
George,
you'll be all over the neighborhood.
You might want to turn that question around and ask Stanton, suppose SETI detected a signal, would that end the interest in ufology?
I don't think so, because detecting a signal from out there doesn't mean there's nobody coming here.
If anything, it might maximize it even more.
Now, whether it would move the government to change what it's doing, that's another story.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hello.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
This is Kristen from West Palm Beach, Florida.
Kristen, welcome to the program. And who do you address your question to?
Actually, I have food for thought for both of your guests,
right,
and I would like their response or reaction to it.
Sure, go ahead.
In my experience, it appears that your guests are looking for ETs in a particular manner as far as their visitation in some type of a craft and in some type of a form. In my experience, ETs actually are not only visiting this planet, but are walking amongst us and are in human form.
Hmm.
Well, that's an interesting hypothesis. I cannot disprove it, and there are some very interesting UFO-related reports, if you will, which do seem to involve beings that look more or less like us. The Travis Walton case, for example, he saw little strange little guys, but there's also somebody that was taller than Travis, and he said would pass anywhere. So whether these are hybrids or spies, you know, if you're going to spy in China, you don't send a tall blonde Norwegian. You send somebody who looks Chinese.
Exactly.
So I'm not saying there is nobody here. I'm saying I don't know what to do about that. They're not coming forward and saying, oh, by the way, here's my driver's license. I'm from Zeta Reticuli 1. So I can't rule that out, but I'm not ruling it in either.
I think that there's something, Kristen, if I may be permitted to say this, there's something you should consider, that the aliens always seem to look a lot like us. Even if they don't look identically like us, they often are reported to look like us, and you should be suspicious of that. Because if, for example, dinosaurs had developed intelligence, and they thought that maybe aliens were visiting them, what would you think of their descriptions if they said, well, the aliens are, you know, very small at one end, big in the middle, and small at the other end, they look like dinosaurs?
Well, most of the reports of aliens associated with abduction cases, physical trace cases, 16% of those 5,000 physical trace cases involve reports of small beings, typically small. So two arms, two legs, a head and a body. Certainly the average alien any place except New York City would stand out like a beacon. I wouldn't say they looked like us. Of course, we may have a common ancestry. We may be somebody's colony. We may be somebody's crop. That's a horrible thought. But so we can't rule out. You remember Australia and Georgia were both settled by convicts initially, which was certainly related to other civilizations than the indigenous ones.
But surely, Stanton, you're aware that if you're going to postulate that we were colonized by intelligent beings, that the ancestors of Homo sapiens were beings that came from another planet, what about the whole history of evolution on this planet, which shows that we are related all the way back.
I'm considering that we know practically nothing of the history of civilizations on this planet back a billion years.
But we know a lot about the physiology of the critters that are on this planet, and there is a very straightforward DNA relationship between us and just about everything you find, not only in the zoo, but everywhere else. So if we've been colonized, they colonized the planet at the beginning.
Well, how long ago was the beginning? A billion years?
So
that's good
that
enough.
That flies in the face of biology.
I'm not saying that there isn't a commonality to life in the whole neighborhood. My great-great-great-great-great-grandparents didn't live in North America. We got here by colonization. Migration, I guess, would be
much more effective. Yes, but they had to bring everything 4.5 billion years ago, or 3.5 billion years ago. That strikes me as quite an hypothesis.
Let's go west of the Rockies now. You are on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
I declare it a slugfest and a draw. I have two questions.
They are tabulating the results. We'll have them in about 20 minutes.
Stan mentioned Zeta 1 and 2 Reticuli. Question to Seth, were those on your SETI target list? And the second question, spacecraft maneuvering near the Earth with interstellar driver using radio or laser navigation, could they be detected on either optical or radio telescopes? And I'm thinking of the enigmatic gamma-ray bursters. Could these possibly be warp drives?
Yeah, no, the gamma-ray bursters are now identified, and they're mostly extragalactic sources. So that, if they're warp drive, they're really far away. You don't have to worry about those guys. And your first question about Zeta Reticuli, that is Stan says they're G-type systems. They're solar-type stars. 39 light years away, they would be on our on the list of Project Phoenix. They would have been observed with the Parkes radio telescope in Australia, and there were no signals coming from them.
No signals.
Nope.
Thank you.
You are quite welcome. First time caller line, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, my name's Veronica. I'm actually currently traveling through Kansas, but I'm from Southwest Florida.
Hello, Veronica.
Hi. The more I listen, the more I realize we're actually discussing two totally different places that people are looking for alien life. But I had a question for Seth, because there are so many people that have experienced firsthand abductions, and, I mean, there has been, overwhelming evidence of physical, almost abuse that has been put on them, even in hospitalization. And I want to know what his opinion is to these people and what has happened to them.
Yeah, well, I have to say, Veronica, of course, unfortunately, I'm not, in a clinical field where I would be able to tell you firsthand. I can only tell you what people who have looked into this have told me, and that is that abduction, either perceived, something that they feel that they've experienced, and abduction where people really are abducted. Well, that obviously happens all the time. You find those people on milk cartons, but there have been there are far more people who feel that they have been abducted in the middle of the night, and that's a phenomenon that's very old. That can be traced back to the Middle Ages, except in those days they didn't say it was aliens. They said it was a succubus or it was the devil or something like that. There are experiments that are being conducted. John Mack at Harvard described an experiment in which he, in fact, took people that were abductees that had roommates, that is to say, either a spouse or, just a college roommate or somebody else that was asleep in the same room as they were, and he tried to find out, they would ask the roommates, did these people disappear in the middle of the night, right? Were they really physically abducted? And it just doesn't seem that they were.
Stay with us. Seth Shostak, Stanton Friedman will be back. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, and your calls with Stanton Friedman, Seth Shostak. Stan, you want to give us your phone number, your toll-free number, and your address. You've got a very special offer for Coast listeners.
Yeah, the offer is an autographed copy, personally autographed copy, of Crash at Corona, the definitive study of the Roswell incident. My CD-ROM, UFOs, The Real Story, and Volume 2 of Flying Saucers Are Real, a video. It's, I think, 78 minutes long. The whole package for $25, including shipping and handling. The number to call after the program is over, please, is 877-457-0232. That's toll-free, 1-877-457-0232. If you prefer checks instead of credit cards, that's Visa or MasterCard on the call. You can send a check to Stan Friedman, Post Office Box 958. Houlton, H-O-U-L-N, Maine, M-E, 4730-0958. And somebody is calling.
They're
right
calling
now.
I can hear your caller call waiting popping
yes.
in. And Seth, for you, your book's available on Amazon.com?
Yes, Amazon, usual outlets for books.
Excellent. And are they available on the SETI website or just through Amazon?
They are indeed available on the SETI website, indeed.
Excellent. The SETI website, of course, linked up with coasttocoastam.com, but it's SETI.org. Let's go back to the calls. The clock is ticking here, and we'll have the results. They are telling me in about 13 minutes or so. They have had a little bit more come in than they expected, so they've brought in more personnel to count them. Let's go east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Greg. I'm calling from Pennsylvania.
Greg, welcome to the program.
I have a question for Seth.
Yep.
And this is about all the biblical scriptures and all the biblical paintings that have shown and told stories about, just like in the Red Sea when it was parted, about the magnetic force from a cylinder that was claimed to be a UFO at the time. And I wanted to hear your outlook on this, about all the paintings and all the scriptures that talk about it.
Okay, and I'll let you listen on the radio. Seth, do you want to react to that?
Well, Greg, I wish I could react in great detail, because I'm not familiar with the various, I mean, obviously I'm familiar with the story of the Red Sea, but I'm not familiar with some of these others, cylinders, metal cylinders and so forth and so on. I don't recall that from scripture, so I can't help you too much there. Only to say this, in just in a general way, that I do think you have to be fairly skeptical about these sorts of things, because There are many ways to interpret these things, of course, just as there are many ways to interpret, for example, Genesis, right? Was the earth really created in 7 days? And the order in which they were created doesn't really quite accord with cosmology as we know it now. But that's okay because it was more allegorical. So I think that you have to apply those same sorts of standards, at least I would, to Scripture and you know, be careful not to overinterpret interpret things.
I should say I recommend Dr. Barry Downing's book, The Flying Saucers. Good place to start on that subject.
And people, stop calling Stanton. We can hear him. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Oh, George, how you doing? It's good to hear your program.
Thank you.
I'd like to direct my comment towards Stan, actually to both of them.
Sure.
Stan, this is Jim from Pittsburgh. I think you know me.
Yes, I do.
I wanted to have been enjoying the contest tonight, and one of the things I wanted to point out, the Condon Report, when it was initially planned and the contract was issued for it, one of the reasons that the University of Colorado got that report supposedly was because nobody else wanted it. And as I recall, we sat in on a meeting at the Astro Laboratory, and we tried to get the report and were sort of told to mind your own business. Do you recall that?
Well, I remember there was some discussion about possibly bidding on that, but I do know, this George will like this, my first copy of the Condon Report, the Bantam Books version, came from KDKA Pittsburgh, because I've been on their talk show, Contact, a number of times, and they let me know that they were getting an advance copy, and would I appear to discuss it? They didn't tell me it was going to be 965
Yes, it was.
But I must say, the press gave us a fair shake on that one. Jim, you may recall that. They asked our opinion. They listened to what we had to say. They printed it accurately. So, yeah, I don't know what all went on behind the scenes with regard to the House and the Condon Report and so forth. I wish I did know, but I don't.
Okay, well, I just enjoyed the program, and we're going to continue listening. Thanks.
All right, good. Thanks, Jim. Next up, west of the Rockies, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi. Yes, I'm wanting to direct this to Stan, please.
Stan.
I mean, not Stan.
Seth.
Seth, yes,
okay.
Thank you. Seth, in defense of Mr. Friedman, in using your own chosen field, so to speak, against you, how can you honestly, after over 100 planets have been found, granted, yes, of a gas giant size, and knowing that that... Hello?
Yeah, we've got you.
Okay, so I was breaking up for a moment. How can you not think that there isn't other planetary bodies out there that could support life, be it more advanced than...
Well,
what
no. Wait a minute. Let me interrupt for just 1 second. Seth believes that there is life out there. He doesn't believe it's come here yet. Okay?
Okay.
I mean, he's a strong believer, as Stanton is, that there is intelligent life out there in the universe. He believes we just haven't found it yet.
Now, I should add, incidentally, with Seth's numbers, he's saying that only 1 in 1,000,000 of the stars in the galaxy have advanced civilization, which makes us pretty special, since I guess we're an advanced civilization. We can listen for signals from other ones. I say they're far more common than that because there's been migration and colonization, and the evidence indicating they're coming here, I don't think they're coming from the other side of the galaxy. So we have a different interpretation, but certainly we agree that there's life, that numerically we give different values to that out there.
Okay, and Seth, I trust I... spoke well of what you believe, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, and the caller is correct, of course. We have found, we've discussed that, more than 100 planets around other stars, but indeed they tend to be very large planets because that's the type of planet that we can find. So maybe that's not so surprising. If you were to fly over Africa at 10,000 feet looking for life, you probably wouldn't see the field mice. You might see the megafauna, like the hippos and the giraffes and the elephants, but that doesn't mean that's the most plentiful type of life. In fact, it's not. So, I certainly think that they're out there. But on the other hand, as a scientist, you have to say, look, until you have the data, until you have compelling evidence, you have to say, okay, that's your hypothesis. Now prove it.
How do you both feel, by the way, of Stephen Hawking changing his views about black holes? Seth, how do you feel about that?
Well, that's what you call progress, I guess. Stephen Hawking has changed his views on black holes several times, in particular things like time travel and so forth. The thing is that black holes, of course, represent an extreme situation in nature where you have no forces able to resist the crushing of matter. And so that's where our physics really doesn't work very well. So it's maybe not so surprising that we learn new things when we study black holes. And so I find it very interesting that, the black holes put this stuff back into our universe rather than sucking mass into somebody else's universe.
Stanton, you want to react to that?
Well, just a quick comment that the whole history of astronomy and astrophysics over the last 120 years has been one of, to their credit, reevaluation of old concepts and changing them. Our notions of how big the universe is, how old the universe is, what are things like on the surface of Venus or Mars? There's a whole host of statements that have been made in the past that turned out to be wrong. It's why when people ask me about far-out theoretical concepts, I say, hey, give me the real world first. The theory is only as good as the evidence we can find to support it. So I'm glad Stephen Hawking had the guts to stand up and lose a bet publicly about what a black hole is like. But, it's a little bit like how many angels fit on the head of a pin. You can have beautiful arguments, and nobody may be right.
Well, that's true, too. Wildcard line, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yes, sir.
I have a great show, by the way. I have a question for Stanton.
Sure.
Sure.
Stanton, my question is about MJ-12.
Yes.
And one of the rumored members of MJ-12, Dr. Donald Menzel.
Yes.
I've read somewhere that Dr. Menzel, at some point later in life, developed a hobby of drawing pictures of aliens.
He called them Martians, incidentally. He didn't call them aliens, but yes.
Great.
Yes, certainly. He was well known. He was a good artist. He also wrote science fiction under another name, incidentally. But he also led a double life, as noted in my book, Top Secret Magic. Or you can go to my website. There are two articles that deal with the arguments pro and con about Majestic 12. My discovery that Menzel had a longer continuous association with the National Security Agency, more than 30 years as of 1960, as he said to Jack Kennedy, yes, that Jack Kennedy,
yes.
And that he did classified work for the CIA and 30 other companies. He taught cryptography. He was a man, none of that was known in the 8-page appreciation of him that appeared after his death in Sky and Telescope. I didn't like the man when I started my work. I came to develop an appreciation for him and his ability to keep most scientists away from ufology. Well, apparently he was on the inside. And I talked to a colleague of his, and I said, I'm having trouble understanding this. Could he really have, on the one hand, debunked, and on the other hand, been on the inside? And he laughed, and he said he would have loved it, this colleague of Menzel for more than 20 years. He would have loved it. Don felt he was smarter than most people anyway, which he probably was. And so it gave me a whole new view on him. I'd had one run-in with him, and he had said, you can't be a scientist and believe, at which I laughed, and which he got angry. I was just inviting him to my lecture at Harvard. Incidentally, there will be a SETI conference at Harvard on August the 7th. Now, you can't buy a ticket at the door, unfortunately. Go to planetary.org, and you can find out a lot of outstanding people, although, Seth, I gather you're not one of the speakers at that conference.
I'm not going to be going. Frank Drake from our institute will be going.
Yes. The top name, Horowitz, is going to be there, and a whole bunch of people. But they're not going to have individual question and answer periods, only to a panel. I haven't decided whether I'll go or not. I don't think they'd ban me at the door if I bought my ticket in advance.
Nobody's going to ban you, Stanton. No. Let's go to our first-time caller line. We're getting to the end here. Go ahead. You're on Coast to Coast.
Hello, George. It's a pleasure to be on the show this morning.
Thank you.
I'd just like to address my comment or question here to Seth, and I'd like to preface it by saying that, Seth, my father was in the NSA from the mid-60s to the early 70s, and the process that he went into the NSA and came out was very secret, and the secrecy that Stanton speaks of is real. And my question to Seth is, has he ever heard of Richard Doane's book, UFOs and the National Security State?
I haven't, no.
Pretty good book.
I'm sure Stanton's familiar with that book, as well as many of the primary sources that book is based on. As well, as I'd like to say to Seth, would he consider this phenomena to be more of a multidisciplinary approach than such a, limited approach from the astrophysical perspective?
Well, when you say this phenomenon, do you mean UFO phenomena?
I mean the UFO phenomena. I mean what Stanton speaks of as actual sightings that are documented and have been documented, as Stanton has proven tonight.
Well, of course it's multidisciplinary because you're dealing with various kinds of purported evidence, right? You've got witness testimony. That's something that maybe you ought to get lawyers to evaluate. I don't know. You also have the kind of radar evidence that Stanton talks about. I mean, you know, radars see all sorts of stuff. I mean, there are various phenomena that produce things on radar. So you should have somebody who's familiar with that. If to the extent that there's physical evidence, and I'm appalled that after 57 years, all we have is very indirect physical evidence. But, you know, you need experts on that. So, of course, yes, you're quite right. It is multidisciplinary. Yeah.
Now we have the results that they have tabulated, and we're going to give you in a percentage form, I am told, the results of the debate. If you would, sir, please.
The results of the debate.
Okay.
The results of the debate end up with Stanton with 57%, Seth with 33%, and a draw at 10%.
Okay, so of the listeners who fast-blasted us tonight, 57% believe that Stanton had won this debate, 33% believe that Seth did, and 10% ended up in a draw.
How many voted, George?
Thousands.
Really?
1,000. I had to cut it off because they're still coming in. Yeah, but I would say that the margin of error is probably plus or minus 5% or so.
Okay.
Stanton, I'm sure you're happy. Seth, are you disappointed?
Well, no, I'm not disappointed.
Of course not. You've both been great guests. You continue to share insight into how you feel and your views. And I think the most important thing, whether we've been visited here or not, depending on your own particular view, is that you both believe that there is indeed intelligent life out there in the universe. And I think that alone is a pretty dramatic statement, don't you both?
Yeah, the question is whether there's intelligent life here, isn't it, George?
Yeah, exactly. And we don't mean extraterrestrial life
either.
Well, it would be a shame indeed if this universe would... hundreds of billions of galaxies, each with hundreds of billions of stars, was created only for our purview, that we are the only ones that can look up at the sky and understand something about the cosmos in which we live. So,
absolutely. Seth, I'm glad you're feeling better. You sound good. Let's get some rest, okay?
Okay.
And Stanton, thank you again, my friend, always.
My pleasure.
Stanton Friedman, Seth Shostak, debating whether UFOs exist and whether we've been visited.